We'll hear argument next in case 07312, Florida Department of Revenue versus Piccadilly Cafeterias. Mr. McCarr.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The virtues of reading Congress's grant of the stamp tax exemption 1146C to only post-confirmation transfers is threefold. First, it's faithful to the language of the statute, which requires it to be a plan confirmed, as the courts in NVR and Hechinger have held, and draws a simple bright-line test at the point of confirmation, at which point the bankruptcy judge has the power to grant that tax exemption. It's also faithful to the principle that taxation exemption statutes, which this is a case involving one, must be narrowly construed in favor of the state under principles of federalism. And it also avoids the intrusion into the state's tax system, keeping in mind an important fact that approximately three-quarters of these Chapter 11 cases never get to plan confirmation. Instead, in three-quarters of the cases you have, as in Lemie and in the Hartford case, you may have a case convert to Chapter 7 or have it be dismissed. So a pre-confirmation tax exemption granted by the bankruptcy judge at any point prior to confirmation.
I don't understand that. If it's never confirmed, then I guess the tax is okay, isn't it?
Well, Justice Breyer, what happens in these situations is that, for example, a 363 sale order where the property is being sold, in that order, there is an exemption granted by the bankruptcy judge.
So what? Isn't that — I mean, I'd assume that's totally illegal, that you get your — I thought we're talking about this provision where everybody agrees that it has to be under a plan confirmed under Section 1129. So if there's no plan confirmed, I don't know how you'd fall within this exemption.
Well, that's our point exactly, Your Honor.
Fine. If it's your point exactly, then I guess I must agree with that. I'll hear from the other side. Except I thought your point was it makes a difference whether the transfer takes place before the plan is confirmed or after. So I may be just confused.
Well, what happens in these situations before confirmation, where there's a 363 order or some other transfer that the bankruptcy court then says this is entitled to an exemption, at that point in time, the state of Florida or whatever state is denied the revenues that would otherwise —
No, I'm asking you this. You then concede — let me, for my own point of view, forget what the — just maybe I'm confused about the facts, or maybe I'm not. But let's suppose there is a plan, and it is confirmed. The transfer, however, took place a month earlier, where a private group of creditors came together, every creditor, with the debtor, and they worked out a sale tomorrow. And they transferred the assets tomorrow. 4 months later, the plan that includes every word of that goes before the bankruptcy judge. The bankruptcy judge thoroughly understands the situation, and he says, I confirm the plan. Now, under those in that circumstance, I guess you now are you prepared to concede that Florida cannot tax?
No, Your Honor.
Of course not. So then the fact that there is no plan seems to me irrelevant, that situation, from the present case. But now let's look at this case where there is a plan, and it is confirmed. My question, going back to what I thought the facts are, is this. Imagine the situation I've just described. Thorough investigation later by the bankruptcy judge. Plan including it is confirmed. And you say, if the transfer took place first, you can assert your tax. But if the transfer took place second, after the plan, you can't. And my question, if I'm right on my assumption, is I'd like you to provide a reason why any human being, a reasonable human being, would want to make that distinction. Why would anyone want to say we want to give all the money to the creditors and not let Florida get some, if it takes place the transfer after the confirmation, but would think differently about it and would want Florida to get some, if the transfer takes place before the confirmation, which confirmation describes everything in depth and is thoroughly investigated, etc.? What reason could there be for such a distinction?
Well, two things, Justice Breyer. First of all, the Bankruptcy Code speaks in terms of a plan, or 1146C speaks in terms of a plan confirmed.
I'm not speaking of the language for the moment. I want you to forget about the language and assume the language is ambiguous. That's a different question. My question is, assuming that the language is ambiguous, as every lower court has found, assuming that, however, is there any reason why a reasonable human being would make this distinction? That's my question, and there may be an answer, but I want to know what the answer is.
Sure. In this context,
I mean, you could say this was Congress, right?
I'm sorry.
That is not an answer. I would appreciate an answer to the question.
Well, Justice Breyer, I think the practical reason is Congress has created this structured bankruptcy code in which there is a plan confirmation process, a structure that Congress has provided here. And in this particular case, and in perhaps a hypothetical, this was done outside the plan confirmation process. In other words, this sale was done even before a plan was even filed.
I suppose one of the reasons would be that how far do you go back? I mean, you go back 3 years and say, well, you know, the bankruptcy judge can say part of what I'm confirming is the sale that took place 3 years ago. Well, so you can file for a refund, I guess.
Well, that's the fundamental problem we have.
That's the problem? If that's the problem, I thought that there had to be a filing for bankruptcy before any of this kicks in.
Well, there certainly is. There has to be a filing of
okay, the commission. Okay. Then the answer can't be. You could go back 50 years. The answer would have to be you go back until the filing for bankruptcy.
Well, why does there have to be? There has to be a filing for bankruptcy before you get a plan confirmed. But I didn't understand that to be the threshold before. I mean, what does that mean? There has to be a filing for bankruptcy, that the confirmation of a plan can't go back before then?
Well,
it goes back before then in a lot of cases to look for preferential transfers and things like that.
Well, sure. But here, what we have is the language of the statute, 1146C, is keyed in to a key event, which is the plan confirmation, the plan confirmed, the authority for the bankruptcy judge to grant the tax.
I thought your answer to Justice Breyer was saying there's another key event, and that's the filing of the petition for bankruptcy.
Well, I don't see that as having any relevance as to the authority of the bankruptcy judge to grant the tax exemption. The question I understood was how far back can you go? And our position on that is opening this up to pre-confirmation transfers creates all sorts of problems.
What? That's what I want to know, and I'll add a qualification. I'd say I would read into this a context, and the context is the whole section that gives the exemption from the state law only kicks in when you file for bankruptcy. So now it's my question. I guess I could make the hypothetical the way I want to make it. And the way I want to make it is that this section applies once it kicks in the bankruptcy filing, and it does not distinguish between the pre- and the post-confirmation, you know, where the confirmation takes place after the transfer after the confirmation. You're arguing to the contrary. And what I want to know is what reason there is. Do I have to repeat the question?
No.
What is the reason? That's what I want you to focus on for making that distinction.
Well, as I understand the question, Justice Breyer, you're concerned about the pre-confirmation transfer and that ultimately gets wrapped into the plan that's ultimately confirmed. And why shouldn't that be occur here? Our position is that
the case is about
that, right, and that's the language of the statute, in our view, provides that the authority flows from the confirmed.
He wants the reason why that might be.
Yes.
Do you know many instances in which Congress has set up a system in which you cannot determine whether a state tax is valid or invalid until some future event at an indeterminate time, which may be 3 years later? Is that customary?
No, in fact, that's
for someone not to know whether the tax is payable or not for sure
until
3 years later?
No, that's exactly our argument.
Isn't that a good reason?
Well, that's our argument, which is that it is not narrowly construing the statute. It's broadly construing it as the 11th Circuit did.
There's another assumption that is in Justice Breyer's question about, well, you have to have the petition, the bankruptcy petition, but in this very case, wasn't the basic arrangement made the day before the petition was filed?
Right. This appeared to be one of those so-called prepackaged plans where it was arranged and was sort of put together outside a formal plan confirmation process. Under the bankruptcy code, typically there's a filing of the petition and there's the filing of the plan.
You were asked and I think tried to answer and never got your answer out, and I'd like to hear what is it you were saying about cases in which if pre-confirmation transfers are made and, no, and the tax exemption is made, did you start to tell us that you might never recover the tax later on, or what kind of a problem does it create? That's
precisely my point. In three-quarters of these cases, approximately, these exemptions can be given.
Yeah, but then the question is, can you get, nevertheless, in an untimely fashion, eventually get the tax imposed, tax collected?
Possibly, if it's been escrowed. Possibly. It takes a tremendous amount of monitoring in these cases. There's a problem of notice. The state doesn't get notice.
Are there also instances, and again, I'm interested in Justice Breyer's question and Justice Stevens' question, the practical reasons that might have prompted the statute to be drawn in the way that you say it's been drawn. Are there also instances where a transaction goes through and is later unwound, is later set aside so that the tax has to be refunded?
Yes. I mean, that could be a possibility. That's our position, is that this is sort of turning this into a refund statute, perhaps in some instances, by allowing all these pre-confirmation transfers to be eligible for the exemption, keeping in mind the sole question in this case is, are pre-confirmation transfers ever eligible? We don't think they are because, as the courts in NBR Hechinger said, the natural, simple, bright-line test is if you get to plan confirmation, if you've gone through the process that, that Congress has established and you get a plan confirmed and then the transfer of the security, this is not a securities case, but the transfer of the private property, is at that point then exempt from the tax. So in our view, the purpose of the statute would be thwarted by allowing all these pre-confirmation exemptions. As I say, in 25% of the cases, perhaps it will get to plan confirmed, and perhaps.
Counsel, I'm not sure I understand the practical consequences of your position. I assume that if you're right, people who have an interest in buying the bankrupt business will wait or have to wait until after confirmation of the plan, because the tax liability is going to save them a lot of money. But is it going to work in that case?
Work in the sense?
I mean, will the effect of your plan be that it will discourage people who come along and want to buy a bankrupt business?
No, I think we have to put this in context. What we have here is a Chapter 11 reorganization. And then Chapter 7, of course, is liquidation, which is typically where the assets of a company would be liquidated and sold off and you have a trustee. Here we have a different context. It's reorganization. Congress established this reorganization process.
But are you questioning what I understand to be the case, that it's not at all uncommon for a Chapter 11 these days to have the 363B sale of property, then have some kind of global settlement, and then distribute all the assets, never have any kind of reorganization? And I didn't understand that it was necessary to kick the case over into Chapter 7. Aren't there many cases filed under Chapter 11 that end up with no reorganization?
There are a number. And I'm not sure exactly the number, but it's a small but growing percentage in which the debtors are taking advantage of Chapter 11 to liquidate rather than go through Chapter 7. And there's reasons for that. There may be that the debtor in possession of the company has greater control than a trustee would and so forth. Our point is that this is, in this liquidation context, it's basically trying to hammer a Chapter 7 peg into a Chapter 11 hole, because what is happening here is the tax exemption that Congress has set up here, which should be narrowly construed in favor of the states, is being broadly expanded. In fact, what the 11th Circuit did below.
What harm is done? Could you tell us in just a few words what's the harm? What Justice Breyer's concerned about.
Well, the harm, Justice Scalia, is that in these instances, as I say, 75% of the cases, if the exemption is being granted unjustifiably, the state has to expend resources and litigation. And there's now a new test, and there has to be going back to court. There's
just not litigation. What you've said so far is, at least as I've taken it in, that the practical harm is the following. There will be a certain number of transfers that take place after the filing, but before the actual confirmation. And in respect to those transfers, the state is left in a position of uncertainty. You don't know if you can assert your tax or not assert your tax until that transfer is later confirmed as part of a confirmed plan or not. That's what I take it as you're having said. And then I think I'll hear in a minute somebody say. But that kind of uncertainty is rife in the tax laws. It often occurs that a taxing authority is not certain about how to characterize a transaction until later events take place, which are part or related to the transaction, and the IRS and all the state tax departments survive. So if I'm right in guessing that, discuss. That's
well,
all
well,
I
sure. Well, sure. As I said, the notice provision is one. The state may not get notice. For example, in NVR, it was 5,000-something transfers of property that, if it happened in the state of Florida, we'd never get notice of to even object to them. If it's in the 363 context, we probably don't get notice because we don't own the property that's being transferred. All this pre-confirmation effort and expenditure of resources on the states have to monitor these and then try to undo that.
What about the solvency?
Excuse me.
What about the solvency of the person who has tentatively been declared exempt from your tax, so therefore you can't go get them right away? This is not the ordinary citizen. This is somebody who is on the edge of bankruptcy. You would normally want to get your money out of him as soon as possible before he squanders what is left, right?
Well absolutely.
And would it not happen with some frequency that even though you could have collected the tax 3 years earlier, by the time it turns out for sure that there's never going to be a Chapter 11 confirmation, he doesn't have any money
left. The tax is imposed on the purchaser, not the bankrupt, isn't it?
I'm sorry, just
isn't the tax imposed on the purchaser rather than the bankrupt estate?
Well, under Florida law, it's imposed upon the transaction. It can either be paid by the buyer or the seller. But the question here is,
can you? That's what I don't understand about how the Florida system works. I thought you don't get the transfer recorded until you pay the tax. I thought that's what Florida law was.
That's correct. But here, what is happening is with these pre-confirmation orders that are coming out with regularity, those are being used to prevent the taxes from being paid, and the recordation goes forward.
Why can't you just say that? Why can't you say, you want to record this transaction, pay the tax? And when you come in later, because it was confirmed, show us the paper, we'll give you the money back. How does that interfere with anything?
Well, it becomes an administrative burden. So
why is it it's an administrative burden? The burden's entirely on the people who want their money back. They come in, they file a piece of paper, it says federal bankruptcy judge signed, plan confirmed, and it would take, I guess, a few minutes to read through it to see they're telling the truth, which you always have the problem in a tax, and then you give them their money back.
Well, but again, what is happening is with these orders being granted, sometimes the state doesn't even know about it. Sometimes we
of course you can't file it if they don't tell the state. So if they're not going to tell you, they're not going to have their transfer recorded. I mean, look, we're going into this, and on the other side, of course, there is the following consideration, that there are creditors who are owed a lot of money. And all these creditors are in a room, and they think, if I can sell these assets tomorrow, I'm going to get a lot more money than I will if I have to wait for 6 months. That's why we want to go through with this. Now, isn't that an important bankruptcy interest to make the creditors more whole?
Well, the state of Florida doesn't want to stand in the way of, nor do the other states, in the way of maximizing the value of the estate. And in this situation here, we're talking about a very small tax that's only imposed in this limited context for when a confirmation plan comes out in Chapter 11.
Mr. McCart, you were going to address, I take it, the assumption that Justice Breyer has asked you to make, which is that the language here is ambiguous. Well, and your position is, I take it, that confirmed means confirmed.
Well, absolutely. I don't concede the way our first argument, I think, is very powerful, which is that the language of the statute itself, put in the context of the Chapter 11 confirmation process, read in its context, which is put in the post-confirmation section, powerfully supports the position that this is a post-confirmation transfer exemption.
I don't understand why this is a big deal. Assuming that was news to me that this only arises after the filing of a bankruptcy petition, and you're looking forward to confirmation of a plan. This tax only applies at the transfer of title. Why don't you just get your deal together and just say, well, the closing is going to be the day after confirmation of the bankruptcy plan?
Well, and
that's when you transfer title, and that's when you have to pay the stamp tax.
Well, that, in the ordinary course of things, is what this statute envisions. That's, of course, not what happened here, but that's the ordinary. Of course, in this exemption.
Sometimes don't they want the transfer to be effective whether or not there is a later confirmation? I thought that that was the assumption here, that some of these transfers, they want to be effective whether or not a confirmation occurs later.
Well, and that's what happens in some of these cases that are transferred to Chapter 7 or dismissed, where they get the tax exemption and then get out of the Chapter 11 world, having gotten the tax exemption, leaving the state to have to unravel what has been done. That's the beauty and simplicity of the bright-line rule of Hechinger and NVR, which is that the language of the statute says post or says confirmed plan. It's at that point that the authority of the bankruptcy judge to grant the exemption exists, and thereby makes it self-executed in the sense that plan is confirmed, the order of confirmation provides the authority for the exemption, and from that point forward, it works with some simplicity. It's a very straightforward application of the statute. And it's the most natural reading of the statute as well. So I don't want the court to at all feel as if I'm conceding ground on the language of the statute or the structure of the code and how it applies here. What I think there may be some confusion is simply that in these three-quarters of the cases, these exemptions are being granted, and it is a problem for the states to have to go out there and track them down and figure out what's going on in these cases and trying to unravel those exemptions. So in that regard, I want to make that
very clear. May I just ask this, because I guess this has been the rule in Florida for a while. There's a problem, always, but has been the problem been that you actually don't get the money, or it's an administrative problem of keeping track of things and finding out whether or not you're entitled to it?
Justice Stevens, it could be both. It could be that we don't know about it, so we don't get the money. It gets filed, and we don't. The order is filed with the clerk of court, and therefore the money isn't received.
Are there any studies showing how much money you've actually lost by this practice?
No, we've looked at it to see if there's any data. There's nothing that I could give you that's with any reliability. I would say anecdotally that it's in the low millions rather than, I mean, obviously the stamp tax to the state of Florida is important. It's been in the billions of dollars overall, but that's not the issue. Here, it's, but it is quite a few million of dollars that we believe is that.
Did I understand you correctly? You say you have, in fact, lost millions of dollars in failure to get taxes under this rule.
Anecdotally, like I said, this is in conversations with the Department of Revenue and so forth. There's just no hard data. And that's one of the problems in this area is I did provide the court with some data about the number of plans that are confirmed versus dismissed and so forth, and the number of filings. We have about 1,000.
It seemed to me that normally, because you do require recording, that it wouldn't be all that difficult to keep track of all these cases in which there had been pre-confirmation transfers. And if you did have some file in the computer that had them all there, as soon as if the confirmation did not occur, you could just go ahead and send out the bills on them.
Well, that system does not exist. I don't know how difficult it would be. I would suspect that things sound simple sometimes in theory, then in practice they become very difficult in a state as populous as
I guess your point is that the virtue of a stamp tax is that it's virtually automatic on recording, and you don't have to set out notices and so forth.
Well absolutely. And
the whole point of the stamp tax.
Absolutely. And it makes it at that point in time certain. And the virtue again of the bright line rule is provide certainty, predictability,
How long does it typically take from filing of the petition to confirmation of the bankruptcy plan?
Mr. Chief Justice, the study I cited to the court about the number of cases that can get confirmed and so forth has some data in there. It looks to be it was in quartiles or something along those lines. It looks to be like the average is about. I think it's around 450 to 600 days. I'd have to pull up the data to look real closely. But that's on average. Some can be very quick. Some can take longer depending on the complexity. A prepackaged plan like the one we have before us here, it's not clear here why it couldn't have had the plan confirmed before the transfer. This wasn't a perishable commodity or things along those lines. But there's not a whole lot of
data. Another question I had, is it not true that even under your rule, there'll be a number of cases, even though it was clear that the transaction was after the confirmation, there's an issue as to whether it was under the plan?
That issue could naturally arise, and that was the Jacoby case that, in our view, sort of spawned a lot of the problems here. There may be some issue that arises post-confirmation. We concede that. But that's going to be less often than if we have the range of pre-confirmation, because if we have the range of pre-confirmation transfers now being subject to litigation, it's going to be at least multiples in terms of the burdens on the states.
I have one question as to the operation of the tax in Florida. Suppose a transaction is — there's no bankruptcy — a transaction is completed, stamps are paid, There is then a suit to rescind the transaction on the ground of fraud or mistake. Do you get your money back from the stamp tax?
There is a refund mechanism for certain situations. I'm not sure if that one would be covered, but I believe it would be. So there are some mechanisms to get a refund back under the state system. If there's no further questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brunstad?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the scarcest and most precious commodity in a Chapter 11 case is cash. Without cash, you cannot even get to confirmation. The way in which most debtors generate the cash necessary to get to confirmation, to pay all the things that have to be paid in cash on confirmation, is through asset sales. In fact, this tax exemption is more important for pre-confirmation transfers to the confirmation process than post-confirmation transfers. Here in this case, if you look at the Joint Appendix, page 127, you can see the things that had to be paid on confirmation of this plan, including administrative expenses. In Section 1129, Congress set forth the requirement that certain things have to be paid in cash. Every dollar that is spent to pay a stamp tax cannot be used to pay employee claims, cannot be used to pay for goods and services the debtor desperately needs to reorganize, and cannot be offered to creditors to get their vote in favor of the plan. There is no reason, no reasonable reason, why Congress would have wanted to allow the exemption for a $1,000 transfer that occurs after confirmation, but not to a $10 million transfer that occurs just prior to confirmation.
Because you don't know whether that second one will ever be a sale under a plan, which is what the code requires. It has to be a transfer under a plan. And when it occurs, you don't know whether it's going to be under a plan or not.
Well, Justice Scalia, I think that depends on how you define the term under. And getting back to your prior question.
Well, at the time it occurs, it doesn't matter how you define the term. There is no way at the time it occurs to say that this is a transfer under a plan. There hasn't been a confirmed plan.
There has not been a confirmed plan, but
and
there
that's
are
what it requires, under a plan confirmed.
Well, it requires that there be a plan confirmed. Now, it doesn't say confirmed plan, where Congress intended to foreclose discussion.
It says a plan confirmed. How do you know at the time the transfer is made whether it is under a plan confirmed?
You don't necessarily know, Justice
Scalia. You don't at all know.
In fact, you do know, I presume, on the statistics that the odds are 3-1 against there being a confirmed plan.
Yes, Justice Souter, but that underscores how difficult it is to confirm plans in Chapter 7, why Congress wanted to make it easier by providing this tax relief. You need cash to confirm. For example, the administrative expenses.
I don't quite follow the leap you just made.
Well, the whole purpose of 1146A is tax relief. It's tax relief to provide more dollars for other Chapter 11 purposes. You cannot confirm a plan without hard, cold cash. In the LTV bankruptcy, the administrative expenses that had to be paid in full prior to the effective date of the plan were north of $200 million. This really makes a difference. This is a live, flesh and blood problem.
I thought, Mr. Brunstad, the question was asked, so the state is not going to get its tax at the time of the asset transfer because the cash is needed to eventually have a plan that works. So the state doesn't get its tax, and then it turns out that there is no plan, that the case is dismissed. What happens then? Florida has to get back, at that point gets the tax that it wanted up front?
Justice Ginsburg, the practice is to escrow the funds, so they will be available as an administrative expense if it turns out there is no confirmed plan. In addition, this is no different than any other asset sale in bankruptcy, where if the tax exemption is not allowed, they claim it as an administrative expense.
So they're all paid up front, but they put in escrow. Is that what you're telling me?
That's the practice, Justice Ginsburg. And the reason why Florida is never harmed is because the procedures are the same, whether it's a Chapter 11 case or Chapter 7. They have to come to the bankruptcy court and file a request for payment of this kind of tax anyway.
So there is no case, to your knowledge, not millions of dollars, but there is no case, to your knowledge, where, in fact, people transferred the assets. They thought there would be a plan confirmed. There was no plan confirmed. and then the state was not paid?
None that I'm aware of, Justice Breyer, and here's why that shouldn't happen. It's theoretically possible, but here's why that should not happen. Because when a transfer is made under Section 363, the transfers are made free and clear of all claims and interest. That's what Section 363 provides. If the state wants to get its tax, in the ordinary course, it comes into the bankruptcy court anyway, just as Florida did in this case, to file a request for payment of the tax.
You would have no reason to know the answer to that question. You're not the state. The state has told us that millions of dollars have been lost in taxes not recovered.
But that's because the exemption applies, Justice Scalia. The courts applied this exemption in Chapter 11. This only applies in Chapter 11, not Chapter 7.
But isn't it odd that Congress would have required, we'll assume, this escrow procedure when the odds are 3-1 against the non-taxability? It seems to me that just as a matter of simple efficiency, they would not have required this elaborate procedure when the odds are that the procedure would be to no avail to the bankruptcy state, a state.
No, Justice Souter, because the purpose of Chapter 11, as we know, is to facilitate reorganization, rehabilitation, saving jobs. It is very difficult. Congress understood it would be difficult. That's why it made Chapter 11 more liberal than former Chapter 10 under the Bankruptcy Act of 1898. That's why we have this tax relief, to provide more dollars that are available to make that process actually work. This is a real flesh and blood problem.
Is it often the case, and I don't know, but is it often the case that the people who are engaged in one of these asset purchases are in fact the creditors themselves? In other words, they're owed a lot of money and it said, well, let's take over the business and run it ourselves, is it?
Sometimes, Chief Justice Roberts, but not often. And the reason why we have these asset sales quickly in bankruptcy, think of the warehouse of the bananas. If you file bankruptcy, you've got to sell those bananas right away. You can't wait for months and months and months till the plan is confirmed because there's nothing left to sell. Here we have a business which we call the melting ice cube. It is an operating business with employees, but we got to get it into the hands of somebody with capital quickly. Otherwise, this business is going to be shut its doors. All those people will let go. That's why we had a quick sale here, to preserve value, to preserve jobs. We couldn't wait until the plan confirmation process played out. And in fact, there could not have been a confirmed plan without the sale because the creditors were fighting too hard about who was going to get what. We had to have a sale first. And we had to do it quickly to maximize the value, preserve the business, save the jobs.
Well, I assume that the creditors have an interest in that as well. I don't know how — I mean, they're the ones who could move quickly to get the confirmation of the plan, because they're the ones whose interests have to be addressed before the plan can be confirmed. So wouldn't they have an interest in the melting bananas or whatever?
Chief Justice Roberts, the answer to that question is that the creditors have diverse interests. Secured creditors often want to liquidate quickly. They want to get their collateral liquidated because they may be paid in full out of that. That may leave nothing for the unsecured creditors, the tort victims, the employees who have wage claims, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. In order for there to be cash for those entities, a more negotiated sale or a different process might have to be followed. That's what happened in this case. There was enough to pay the secured creditors in full and give a 45% to 50% distribution to unsecured creditors, including the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
You say the test is whether it's instrumental. The transfer has to be instrumental to the plan. Is that correct?
That's a standard that we offer, Justice Alito.
Is that different from necessary?
Yes, it is. It's more open.
And what does it mean?
Well, basically, Justice Alito, it would encompass almost any pre-confirmation transfer. It's a wide-open standard. I want to be upfront about that. And you could say, you could use a dictionary definition of under, in accordance with. It's about the same. They would cover all of the pre-confirmation transfers where you ultimately have a confirmed plan. Because all of them will be generating cash that make confirmation possible.
I understand your arguments about the desirability. How do you squeeze it into the statutory language?
Well, a couple.
Got to be under a plan, and you're suggesting that it's under the plan before there is a plan.
Well, the standard, the test that 1146A requires is that there be a plan confirmed under Section 1129. So we have three parts of the statute. We have a instrument of transfer. That's undisputed. We do in this case have a plan confirmed under Section 1129, and we do, in fact, have a stamp tax.
Well, the question you missed the crucial part. The transfer has to be under a plan confirmed. I mean, that's the troublesome language. The transfer has to be under a plan confirmed.
But we know, Justice Scalia, that in where the same language is used in Section 365G, it cannot possibly mean post-confirmation events. It cannot possibly, because Section 365G addresses assumptions or rejections of executory contracts under a plan confirmed under Chapter 11. That cannot happen post-confirmation because, as this Court said properly in Bill Disco, assumption or rejection must occur prior to confirmation of a plan. So the same language used elsewhere in the statute, exactly the same, cannot possibly mean post-confirmation. It must mean something else. And we think it means a transfer that occurs either before or after confirmation, as long as you have a confirmed plan. Now, it's also critical that where Congress intended to foreclose the debate, to require that there be a plan first, such as in Section 1142B or Section 511B, Congress said, under a confirmed plan. You cannot insert a verb between confirmed and plan where it's confirmed plan. In this section, Congress, 1146A, Congress said plan confirmed under Section 1129. Does it mean plan that has been confirmed, plan that may be confirmed, plan that is confirmed? It's ambiguous. It's ambiguous. Again, in Section 1142B, Congress expressly dealt with transfers under a plan, under a confirmed plan, and in context, that distinct language means there was a plan first, and then it authorizes parties under the plan to make the transfers that are authorized under the confirmed plan.
Is it relevant, as your friend on the other side pointed out, that the particular section in question occurs within the statute under the general heading of post-confirmation matters?
No, Justice Souter, and here's why. We know, for example, in Section 1145C2, which is also part of Subchapter 3, that expressly applies to an exemption for sales of securities between the petition date and the confirmation date. In addition, Section 1146B itself allows for requests for determination of the tax effects of a plan before the confirmation date. So we know for a fact that the rules in Subpart 3, some of them apply to pre-confirmation periods, requests, and exemptions.
But isn't the normal reading, if we're going to give any weight to the placement in the statute at all, and I think we're entitled to give some, that unless there is the kind of clarity that you've just been describing in these two exceptions, that in fact the placement there indicates that it is dealing with a post-confirmation matter?
I think it's entitled to some weight, Justice Souter, but I think it is completely undercut by the fact that some of the very provisions of Subchapter 3, by their terms, apply to pre-confirmation events. Similarly, some of the provisions of Subchapter 2, Section 1127B, applies expressly to post-confirmation matters. Congress was not consistent in placing things exclusively under one heading or another.
Mr. Brunstad, there's an aspect of the way this worked that I don't understand, and you're an expert in this area, you absolutely didn't explain it to me. You have one of these 363B sales of property, and then you have a global settlement with the creditors. What function does a plan serve after you've had all that? The assets have been sold. The creditors have made a settlement. There's going to be no reorganization. Whatever there is going to be distributed. What is the function of having a plan after all that confirmed? I know one purpose of it is that you avoid paying the stamp tax. But is there any other purpose once you've had already settled that the sale is made, the creditors agree on how it's going to be divvied up? What is the function that the plan serves?
That's an excellent question, Justice Ginsburg, and the answer, I think, is important, and there is an excellent answer. And that is, whereas Chapter 7 liquidations are sort of off the rack, Chapter 11 liquidations are custom-made. The plan is custom-made and tailored to the particular assets and circumstances of the particular case. The assets that were sold in this case was not all the assets to be sold, Justice Ginsburg. That often happens. And this plan provides for the orderly liquidation in a specific way of the assets that weren't, in fact, sold. There are also all kinds of claims that have to be resolved and dealt with. This plan, in a customized way, dealt with the resolution of those claims, the PBGC liabilities, tort liabilities, all different kinds of liabilities and concerns, in a much more efficient and tailor-made way than could have been happened if the case had been converted to an off-the-rack Chapter 7 case. There is a test which the lawyers and the courts apply as to whether we should stay in Chapter 11 when the situation has been that most of the assets have been sold, or whether we should convert to Chapter 7, and that is whether it's in the best interest of the creditors and the best interest of the estate to stay in the Chapter 11. And that test was met here. It was clearly in the best interest to stay in the Chapter 11 because we got that customized procedure. A plan administrator who was appointed subsequently, who's continuing to liquidate assets and distribute the proceeds. We have all kinds of benefits. Now, it is not possible to confirm a Chapter 11 plan simply to escape tax liabilities. Section 1129 says you cannot confirm a plan if the primary purpose is to escape tax liability, so there's a protection for the state there as well. Here, of course, the primary purpose of confirming the plan was not just to avoid tax liabilities. It was to do all these other administrative things in a custom-made way.
What is the section you mentioned earlier that uses under in a sense that clearly applies to pre-confirmation?
Section 365G, Justice.
Yeah, I've been looking for it, and I can't.
We quote it in part on page 38 of our brief, and it is quoted in part on page 17 of the petitioner's brief.
Did you make that argument there?
Yes. Yes, Justice Scalia. On pages 38 and 37, 38, and 39, we specifically talk about Section 365G1, and we cite the Bill Disco case. And specifically made the point.
How does that provision read? Do you have it quoted here?
I do, Justice Scalia. I can quote it for you exactly. Section 365G deals with what the effect of effect of breaching an executory contract is. And there are two subparts, 365G1, which provides if such contract or lease has not been assumed under this section, or, and here's the language that's the same, under a plan confirmed under Chapter 11. So if the contract or lease has not been assumed or under this section, Section 365, or under a plan confirmed under Chapter 11, then the breach is basically deemed to have existed just immediately prior to the filing of the bankruptcy case. It's exactly the same language, and it's also in G2. The same language is used yet again. It cannot be the case that the election to assume or reject an executory contract can occur post-confirmation. It cannot. Why? Because, as this Court explained in Bill Disco, the assumption or rejection must occur prior to confirmation, up until the point of confirmation is the language that this Court used. The lower court decisions, the TWA case, et cetera, all say exactly the same thing, and there's an important reason for that. The standard for assumption or rejection, even if it's elected in a plan, is you have to satisfy Section 365. And that has to be done through a court order and through a court proceeding that has to occur essentially before the court actually confirms the plan. So the same language used.
Why?
Because the debtor has to elect, and the debtor has to make a decision before confirmation so we know what's going to happen to the property, and so the creditor can timely file a claim if it's going to be rejection. Because the creditor does not file a claim for rejection damages from rejection of a contract until the assumption or rejection is determined. That particular thing is postponed. But we must know that prior to confirmation because we have to know how to treat the creditor's claim, if we have to pay that creditor significant money, what's going to happen to the property. For example, Justice Souter, suppose it is a contract to purchase a Boeing 767 for $600 million. The debtor might file for bankruptcy, one of the airlines files for bankruptcy, and might have to decide whether to honor that obligation or to reject that obligation, assume it or reject. We need to have that information. We need to know if the debtor is going to have to pay that $600 million before confirmation. We can't wait till after because it's too important to the plan. It's too important in dealing with the asset. That's why all the courts, including this one, have said you must make the assumption or rejection election up until confirmation. never after. So it can't be the case that the specific language under a plan confirmed under Chapter 11, as used in Section 365, refers to post-confirmation. But that is, in fact, the same language used in Section 1146. Now, contrast that with the language used in Section 1142B or 511B, which talks about a confirmed plan. And in context, that language clearly means a plan comes first. Congress could have used that same formulation in Section 1146A. It chose not to. And under Russolo and the other precedents of this Court, canons of construction, we should give that semantic choice deference. And again, there's a reason where the statute is.
Your argument there is that under a plan confirmed, it means something different than under a confirmed plan.
In context, yes, Chief Justice Roberts. And if you look at Section 1142B, I think you can actually see in context why that so clearly means, the plan comes first and then is confirmed. But again, it's different language that is used.
Do you agree with the proposition that you only go back so far as the filing of a petition? Well, what in your argument suggests that that's a logical stopping point? It seems to me that if you don't take the date of confirmation, I don't know why all of your policy arguments wouldn't cause you to go back further.
By statute, Chief Justice Roberts, Section 103 provides that the provisions of Chapter 11, in Chapter 11, including Section 1146, apply only in a Chapter 11 case. There is no case.
Well, yeah, but we've already shown a willingness to abandon that type of limitation with under a plan confirmed. So, you know, the consideration of the prior transfer is going to take place in the context of a bankruptcy case.
The only sections that apply basically to pre-bankruptcy, pre-petition matters are the avoidance powers in section, for example, the preference actions in Section 547, the fraudulent transfer provisions in Section 548. Those things expressly apply to pre-bankruptcy events, and they say before the 90 days before the commencement of the case, those kinds of things. When Congress wanted to reach back before the petition date, used very specific terms of art, very specific authorizations. Nothing like that appears anywhere in Section 1146A, and for good reason. It's very clear, and every court to have looked at this has so held, that 1146A does not apply before the case is commenced. And that makes sense because the purpose is to give tax relief to facilitate the Chapter 11 process. You want to have cash available.
I just ask this as a practical matter, does the bankruptcy judge enter some kind of an order approving the transfer even though it's pre-confirmation that in order to establish the tax exemption?
Yes, Justice Stevens. In fact, that has to happen.
So all of it would have to be after the filing of the bankruptcy proceeding.
Yes, Justice Stevens, it must, and under Section 363, the bankruptcy court must approve sales like this on notice to creditors, which would include the state. And here, in fact, what happened is consistent with what happens in almost every bankruptcy case. Because the state has an interest, a taxing interest in the transfer, the state will get notice, which Florida gave here. They have an opportunity to come and object if they wish to, which they did here. There are actually more protections for the state for pre-confirmation transfers than post-confirmation transfers. After the confirmation of the plan, the bankruptcy court's work is essentially done. And then you're just out in the world under the plan, and the debtor is making sales and transfers. There isn't the opportunity for the state to come in and actually object to things as there is pre-confirmation. So here the state actually has more protections for the pre-confirmation sales.
How do you know whether to pay the tax or not? I mean, you know that the bankruptcy petition has been filed, but you really don't know whether there's going to be a plan confirmed under Chapter 11. How do you know whether to pay or not?
Well, for example,
I assume there are penalties if you don't pay on time.
There's a very practical reason to that question, Chief Justice Roberts, and that is in this case, the bankruptcy court specifically determined in his order, judge in his order, that the exemption would apply. So that was determined in the order.
Yeah, but of course, this doesn't happen for some time down the road, right?
Well,
up to, I guess we were told up to 400 days.
Well, you can't have the sale until the bankruptcy court approves it. In the process of approval, the bankruptcy court was asked and made the determination that 1146A would apply. Now, what happens then is the state can come in and has the right to file a request for payment of administrative expense, and the funds are escrowed, because if, in fact, there ends up not being a confirmed Chapter 11 plan, then the state is entitled to its tax, and the money is then paid to the state, its request for payment of administrative expenses is allowed, and it gets its money. But this can make
it's always escrowed. That is that.
It's not always escrowed, Justice Scalia. That is the practice, but it's not uniform because in some cases there's no need for an escrow. There are some cases in which we know there's going to be enough cash available that the state will be paid, so we don't need that safety. But the state can always ask for it, and if the state asks for it, I'm almost certain in most cases it will get it.
Is it relevant that this is a tax exemption provision?
Well, I think it's relevant in the sense that Congress was clearly intending here to grant tax relief to Chapter 11 debtors to facilitate the Chapter 11 process. It's not a tax exemption, Justice Alito, in the sense of, for example, an exemption to a revenue-raising provision. In other words, you can have a state statute that says the purpose of the statute is to raise taxes and will create exemptions. That's one context. And there it might make sense to say, well, look, where the overall purpose of the statute is to raise revenue, we might construe the exceptions to that purpose narrowly. Here, the purpose of Chapter 11 is to facilitate the Chapter 11 process. So I think we construe this tax relief measure consistent with that overall purpose.
Why shouldn't we look to see how it was in the Internal Revenue Code with respect to the federal state tax exemption? That, I think, leaves no room for argument. This case might be argued either way about does it apply to pre-confirmed plan asset transfers. But as I understand it, this section 4382B was limited to post-confirmation transfers, that is, transfers made within 5 years after confirmation of the plan.
Well, that's the limitation that the United States wanted to add to Section 267 of the Bankruptcy Act of 1898. Congress did not grant the United States' request. The United States said this is administratively too difficult to administer, and Congress rejected that testimony from the representative of the Treasury and enacted Section 267 over the objection of the United States. Now, the United States, after the Excise Tax Reduction Act, I think, of 1965, does not really have many excise taxes. And so the testimony of the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Code and Revenue Service in 1978, when the Bankruptcy Code is being adopted, is that the United States doesn't really care about stamp taxes. It really didn't have a position
on it. Section, I'm not talking about, you mentioned 267. 4382B, what did that say?
I'm sorry, Justice Ginsburg, I got 42.
Section 26 U.S.C. 4382B.
4382B?
Yeah.
Was that the revenue provisions?
That was in the 1954 code. I'm not talking about 1898.
That one I'm not certain of, Justice Ginsburg.
I thought that said that the tax exemption was limited to transfers post-confirmation.
No, Justice Ginsburg. The history of the development of the statute is Section 77BF, and then went to Section 267, and then went to Section 1146.
Maybe you can straighten me out, because where I get this from is the brief for the states. And it's at page 17, mentions the now repealed 4382B.
That may, Justice Ginsburg, have been a mirror provision. Before 1938, the tax exemption provisions under the Bankruptcy Code were mirrored. There was a provision in the Bankruptcy Act in Section 77BF. There were also mirroring provisions under the Internal Revenue Code. Those were eliminated, and instead, we just have Section 267 under the Bankruptcy Act of 1898, which dealt with the exemption in bankruptcy. But just to answer, I think that, going back to your earlier point, I think it's important to underscore that the context of this case is different from other contexts in which the discussion of how we should construe a tax exemption applies. I think the Court here should apply the analysis that it applied in Dolan, where the Court was considering application of a similar canon of narrow construction, and the Court said, well, in construing the Federal Tort Claims Act, in juxtaposition to this concept that we construe waivers of sovereign immunity narrowly, we don't apply that because that would basically run afoul of the purpose of the Federal Tort Claims Act provisions. The same thing here. The proper rule of resolution where we have an ambiguous statute is to look to the purpose of the statute, and the purpose here is to make Chapter 11 easier by granting tax relief. And I think that consistent with that purpose, the Court should construe Section 1146A
We said in other opinions, no statute pursues its purposes at all costs. And the limitations contained in a statute are as much a part of its purpose as the broad purpose that you just mentioned. And if a plan confirmed means a plan confirmed, that limitation is part of the purpose, no less than the broad purpose that you express.
Well, that's true in general, Justice Scalia, but if Congress had really wanted to narrow the purpose here to post-confirmation, it would have surely used the temporal limitations it used, for example, in Section 1127, where the Court said, before confirmation, you do this. After confirmation, you do that. That is a standard legislative technique used throughout the Bankruptcy Code that was not used in Section 1146.
Maybe, but under a plan confirmed, seems under normal interpretation of language to mean under a plan that has been confirmed.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that as the Court stated in Ardestani, quote, the word under has many dictionary definitions, and we must draw its meaning from its context, close quote. And under Robinson, the Court looked to, where there was an ambiguous statute, the purpose as the way to resolve the ambiguity, and I submit that should happen here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bronstein. Mr. McCarr, you have 5 minutes remaining, and during those 5 minutes, I hope you'll give an answer, if you have one, to the 365 G1 argument that you're...
Sure. I'd be glad to, Mr. Chief Justice. The 365G here speaks in terms of the rejection of an executory contract.
Is that spelled out somewhere in the is its text somewhere in these materials?
The full text, I'm sorry, it is not.
It's on page 38, the last line.
Not the full section, though.
Read brief.
Just little snippets of it.
Right. This provision, 365G, says the rejection of executory contract constitutes a breach of such contract release if the contract release has not been assumed under this section or under a plan. What that means is that it's deemed rejected if at the time of plan confirmation, not before, but at the time of plan confirmation, if it's not in the plan, it's deemed rejected. That's merely an instrument to say when the contract is it's deemed rejected. If it's in the plan, it's not rejected. If it's not in the plan, it's deemed, it doesn't get...
You know, I'm sorry. Doesn't the rejection have to take place prior to the plan being confirmed?
No, it says the rejection
Does it or doesn't it? Prior to, in your opinion, or not prior to?
The rejection may occur before that, but what the statute is referring to is the rejection of an executory contract constitutes a breach. It's defining when it's a breach. And it's only determined to be a breach or not.
I'm sorry, I don't understand how that would work. I have a contract with Boeing for $500 million. I decide to reject it. Now, if that breach doesn't occur until the plan's confirmed, how does the bankruptcy judge know how to treat Boeing as a creditor?
Well, at the point of — the statute speaks in terms of the point of plan confirmation.
I understand that, but I'm sorry. Doesn't the plan, which is confirmed, have a list of the creditors and how they are treated?
Sure.
All right. How do we write the plan if, in fact, no breach has occurred and he hasn't become a creditor until the plan is, in fact, confirmed?
Well, I'm not sure I'm following, but I think the language of the statute here is in a different context, which is saying that the rejection constitutes a breach if it's not been assumed. And at that point in time, if it's not been assumed at the point of confirmation, then
I can understand. I've just taken a quick look at 365G, why it serves a different purpose and a different function. But the respondent's point was you have to interpret under differently under your view, under 365, than under the statute at issue. Do you agree with that?
No, because under a plan confirmed in 365G relates to the point of confirmation or beyond. And we believe under 1146C or 1146A, since Congress has readopted it.
So your argument is that you don't have a rejection of the executory contract until the plan is confirmed. That's what constitutes.
That's what 365, I'm sorry, yes, it's at that point. But that doesn't undermine the argument that under a plan confirmed under 1146C means at the point of confirmation or beyond. And the most natural reading of 1146C is to provide this post-confirmation transfer exemption. No one's contesting that. That's the natural reading of the statute. And the point here of there being more protection and pre-confirmation is simply not the case. The state is not on notice of many of these transfers as an NVR. Those were transfers that were outside the ordinary course of business. We would get no notice of that. And in the ordinary course of 363 practice, the parties that have an interest in the property, the state doesn't, do not get notice of that proceeding. So there's this notion that there's more protection pre-confirmation than post-confirmation is just insupportable. In conclusion, Your Honors, this is a tax exemption statute. And under this Court's principles, it should be narrowly construed. It shouldn't be expanded to these pre-confirmation transfers with all the problems it creates and the three-quarters of the cases that don't get confirmed and have all these intrusions upon the state and local governments in the collections of their stamp tax. For that reason, we ask the 11th Circuit be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted.